Hello, and welcome to Friends for Life, a podcast of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's National Mission. We're here to come alongside you as we journey through life under the cross. What does it look like to care for our neighbors in body and soul? How do we tend to our own body and soul? How can we speak up for life? And finally, how do we share the faith with the next generation? Join us as we have these conversations and learn together. We hope you'll stick around and be our friends for life.
Thanks so much for joining us. I'm your host, Steph Nugebauer, here with my guest, Dr. Thomas Engel. In listening to this episode, we hope you'll learn a whole lot more about the foster care system and how the church can support these kids and their foster parents. Dr. Engel, welcome. Would you please introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Dr. Thomas Engel. My background is in human services, specifically with regard to the effects of displacement for children in the dependency system. I have worked as a child protective investigator, case manager supervisor, guardian ad litem supervisor. I'm also a foster parent myself, and I've also adopted a child out of foster care.
Wonderful. It's so good to have you on. Well, Dr. Engel, you have quite a pedigree here. So you are the guy to go to with starting off to help us learn more about foster care and then, of course, how Christians can help. Can you just kind of paint a picture for us? What is the current state of our foster care system in the United States?
So currently, you're looking at roughly about 500,000 children in the United States will become involved with the child dependency system at some point during this year. That number has been rising fairly steadily by about 3 to 5% over the last 4 or 5 years. The other issue with that is that children are spending significantly more time in the system than they did previously. So you have a, underfunded, overworked system, and then you have additional children coming in and that they're staying in there for longer time frames. So that's not helping.
What do you think some of the factors are that contribute to that? You said the number of kids entering the dependency system is rising and they're spending a longer amount of time. So what contributes to that?
So historically, child welfare started with the focus on safety. And so that's where you saw the orphanages. An allegation of abuse and neglect would come in. They would just come in, assess safety, and immediately remove that child, stick them in an orphanage, and hope that somebody would come in and adopt them someday. And then it evolved, and then they realized that they needed to have some quality of care going on. And so that's where you see orphanages kind of being abolished, and you see the development of the foster care system, trying to put children in family-oriented situations rather than these institutional locations. Although some of those institutional-type placements still exist today, it's not a good place for kids to grow up in. And now the most recent evolution, it has been that they've recognized that we need to do more. We need to be focused on the well-being of children. I think one of the larger reasons, though, for why kids are staying in care longer is because some of the jurisdictions don't understand that the faster you get a child to permanency, meaning you get them out of the system and find a permanent home for them, the better for them. The longer they stay in the system, the worse their outcome will become, even as adults. And I think one of the issues is that we're giving parents longer and longer time frames to work their case plans in order to try and show that they deserve to get the children put back in the home. And unfortunately, that is not to the benefit of children. So we're kind of, in my opinion, giving parents more of the benefit doubt. We're giving them longer time frames to try and work this instead of giving them a solid cutoff date and saying, this is where you need to achieve success or not.
Can you kind of describe some of the situations where kids end up ultimately entering the foster care system? What kinds of things need to happen within the family or under the guardianship of parents for the state to step in?
So it varies. And that's another frustration in my studies is that I've studied child dependency systems not only across the country, but also internationally. And so I can see that some of the figures that I've already put out there, they hold true actually for other countries as well. When you're looking at the United Kingdom, Norway, Australia. So it's not just an American issue, if you will. And so the determinations that they use to decide whether a child is going to come into care or not, it fluctuates a little bit. Each state runs child dependency differently. And in some states, it can vary even from county to county. So literally, what I might determine as an investigator in one state, another investigator in another state might be like, well, that doesn't qualify as far as we're concerned. And there is quite a bit of variance in that, as surprising as that might be.
Tell me a little bit more about what happens then if you're an investigator to assess the family home, to assess the care of the child, and then, you know, the process that ultimately ends up happening where children are taken from their home for a time and placed into the dependency system.
So some states will have a statewide hotline, and so that will come into a centralized location, and professionals there will take the call, and they'll determine whether or not it meets the allegations of child abuse or child neglect. It's usually pretty liberal in the way that they decipher that. The biggest thing is going to be, is there a way to identify the child or the caregiver? You know, you can't just be like, I saw a kid in the park yesterday and somebody was slapping them. Well, obviously that's a problem, but if you can't get some sort of way for us to identify and locate that child, they're probably not going to take that because that's just a dead end. So that would be from the state line. Other states choose to do it on a local level. And in that sense, then you would have to figure out who the local child welfare agency is. You'd have to call that actual particular agency in order to file your concern. So once the complaint comes in, they determine that it meets the need to investigate, they'll send out an investigator. And usually that's done within either a few hours because it's considered emergent, or within the first 48 hours, typically. They'll go out there, they'll make an assessment. If they decide that this child is imminently in danger, they'll go ahead and remove the child right then and there. I mean, that does happen. Other times they need to do a little bit more investigating. They'll have to contact neighbors, school, staff, you know, and kind of figure out the bigger pictures to what's going on.
Then, Dr. Engel, what is the ultimate goal then of the foster care system for both the kids and their parents?
So the goal is almost always going to be reunification. Only in the most egregious instances are they going to go for an immediate, what they call TPR, which is a termination of parental rights. But almost always, we're going to go for reunification. And so when the child is removed, the first thing you're going to do is engage the parents and try and figure out, are there relatives or family friends, which we would call fictive kin, that we could place a child with immediately? Because we always want to try and place that child with somebody that they're familiar with. And the national average for that is approximately 30%. 30% of these kids, when they're removed from parents, are going to end up either with family or fictive kin. The other 70% are going to end up in some either institutional care or foster care. And so in the states that do child dependency better, they try to work with the parent and identify specifically what their needs are. So let's say this child is being removed because of neglect, because the parents have drug issues. So they're going to create a case plan that is specifically designed to address their substance abuse issues. They're going to put them through treatment. Hopefully they'll put them through counseling to address the issues that led them to use substances in the first place. You know, and maybe there's a parenting class. Maybe they feel that these are inexperienced adults and they're not used to parenting. So they feel maybe a parenting class might be helpful. So they try to create the case plan for the individual scenario that the family is involved in. And then typically it should be about a year that they'll give these parents in order to achieve success. And what we're hoping for is behavior change, quote unquote. We're not looking for attendance. Just because you went to substance abuse weekly for 8 months doesn't mean that you learned anything. So we want to see that the parents are demonstrating that they've learned new techniques in parenting, that they've learned how to manage sobriety, that they've learned how to manage the different emotional or mental issues that they might be dealing with in the first place. And at that point, hopefully we can start the reunification process.
About what percent of children get to be reunified with their parents?
So that number is going to fluctuate pretty significantly depending on what state and what county, even like I said, sometimes. I mean, some counties are going to have a higher percentage versus other counties. Some states are going to have a higher percentage than others. It's difficult to really put a number to that. The other concern with that, too, is the repeat, too, is reunifying a child and then having that same child come back into care. And that I will say is not uncommon.
So if it's not uncommon, then potentially children could be reunified and put back into the system, reunified and then put back into the system. Is that correct?
And that is, unfortunately, that is not, like I said, that's not uncommon at all. You'll see a child get reunified. It seems like a good moment. And then 3 or 4 years later, you see that same child rebound back into the system.
Oh. What kind of impact does that have on the kids, especially both in the short term, so like the duration of their time in the foster system, but then also as they come into adulthood?
So studies have clearly shown that children do best when they're in dependency for a year or less, and that they are supposed to achieve permanency within 1 year. Unfortunately, about 20% of the cases nationally will last anywhere between 1 to 2 years. 22% of those cases will last anywhere from 2 to 4 years. And then you have about 15% that are going to last past 5 years. And that's egregious, in my opinion. You're just damaging children irreparably at that point. And when you think about it, a childhood is really gone. I mean, by the time you reach about, even sometimes as early as 14 or 15, really, right? Because they're already starting to be so affected by the things that they have seen and experienced at that point that we're robbing them of their childhood. If you've got a child that we brought into care at, say, 5 years old, and it takes us 7 years to get that child out, that child effectively has no childhood anymore. We have eaten that time up, if you will. And that bothers me when I see systems that do not take an urgency to this. I like to say children don't come with pause buttons. It's something that I've said a lot because it's true. To us as adults, we'll say, oh, we need to continue this case. And everybody just says, oh, okay, we just need to continue it for 3 months. But to me, it's that 3 months to a child is an eternity. And unfortunately, the vast majority of the judicial systems that are operating in the United States, they don't seem to comprehend this. And they just simply write it off as, well, that's just the way the system works. And in my opinion, that should never be the excuse. We need to change the way that we are doing things as adults and as professionals and put the focus and emphasis on getting these children the care that they need and getting them out of the system as fast as we possibly can appropriately.
And then into adulthood, what kind of statistics have proven to be true in terms of later substance abuse for children that were within the foster system, teenage pregnancies, assuming, but perhaps I shouldn't, that becomes just kind of a vicious cycle of brokenness?
It does. You're absolutely correct. And so one of the problems that we run into is that when a child achieves the age of 18, they're now an adult. But let's say they're still in the system to the point where we have not been able to reunify them with a parent. We also have not found a foster parent or any other caregiver or family member who's willing to adopt them or assume the title of guardian for them. What ends up happening is this is called aging out of foster care. The statistics for a child who ages out of foster care is absolutely harrowing. So 60% of the males who age out are going to end up in the criminal justice system by the time they're 21. 70% of the females will have had a child, and that child will also be in the child dependency system by the time that former foster child is now 21 years old. About 70% of them are going to experience homelessness at some point. And as far as mental health illness, about 50% of them are not going to have just one mental health diagnosis, but most of them have comorbidity of psychological diagnoses. So you're talking three or four different mental health diagnoses. And again, being homeless, being unemployed, you add all of those things together, and it's no wonder why we have some of the social issues that we have today.
So what I'm hearing you say is that we don't have a kid problem. We have an adult problem, and it's the responsibility of the adults to be taking care of children and to give children a healthy, reliable childhood experience.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the problem, is that, like I said, as I was talking earlier about the evolution of child dependency, we are only now starting to accept the fact that we need to do a better job as far as how we're taking care of the well-being of these children. And when you look across this country at child dependency, we know statistically that anywhere between 40 to 80%, again, that varies quite a bit, but at least 40% of these children are going to have mental health issues, meaning they need counseling or psychiatric care of some form. They are five times more likely to be diagnosed with depression than children in the general population. They are four times more likely to be diagnosed with ADHD, and they're 10 times more likely to be diagnosed as bipolar. Significant numbers. And yet, not a single child dependency system in this country has psychological or counseling services on retainer. So it falls upon the individual case manager, and I have done this myself. I've literally made 19 phone calls looking for services for this one child that I had. I couldn't find a provider because either they weren't taking new clients, they didn't accept Medicaid, whatever. The excuses went on and on. And to me, that's unconscionable that we know that these children have these issues, but yet we're not properly prepared. It's as if you called a plumber to come to your house and the plumber showed up and then said, oh, I got to go back out, I don't have any wrenches. You would fire that plumber on the spot because you'd be like, how are you not prepared to do the job that I called you for? I don't understand how we know a significant portion of these children are going to have mental health issues that need to be addressed, and yet we're not prepared and we're not making the proper plans to provide that kind of care for them.
So what I see here is an opportunity that's multifaceted for the church. How can the church, specifically local congregations and their congregation members, how can we be involved? How can we care for these kids, the other parents who so desperately need us? And then also, how can the church care for foster parents who are bringing these children into their homes?
So we at Highland have, at Hope Lutheran at Highland here, we have piloted a program. We're calling it the Congregational Foster Family Support Ministry. Basically what it is we have identified two foster families within our congregation that were willing to take in a foster child. The congregation has stepped up and agreed to support these families, and they have with exuberance. It's been phenomenal. People are cooking meals and bringing them for the foster families. They're providing some funds to help out with car seats and diapers and things of like that nature. Because as a foster parent, you get a stipend, but it doesn't cover all of the costs. Providing some babysitting, if you will, some daycare, if you will, just kind of offering a break for these foster parents. And really, any congregation can come up with their own ideas as far as what that individual foster family might need that would be helpful to them. My biggest focus is making sure that we're not funding this ministry, but we're participating in it. And our congregation has done a phenomenal job with that. It's not just a matter of throwing money at it with a GoFundMe attitude, if you will, but actually participating and seeing these children, you know. And on the flip side, the foster families making these children available to the congregation so that they can see them and they can interact with them and see the growth that's occurring for these foster children, and really making it personal. so that everybody can feel like they're legitimately a part of this effort to do God's work, really.
So just like it would take a village to raise a child within a traditional household setting, it also takes a village, the church, to raise children or to support children throughout the foster system.
Yes. So foster parents nationally have about a 40% annual turnover rate because they don't last very long. Because a lot of these systems, it takes time for them to put these services in place for them, right? I mean, it's not just a simple matter of picking a child up and dropping them off at the house and everything is great. You're changing the entire milieu for this child, right? So some of these children will show up with literally nothing but the clothes in their back. So they're going to need a toothbrush. They're going to need toothpicks. They're going to need clothes, diapers, toys, like the full gambit of that. They may need, they'll probably need a car seat if they're young enough. Daycare. A lot of foster parents can't afford to stay at home with this child all day long. So they rely on daycare to help out. And it might take a month for child services in order to them to set that up for the foster parent. By having the congregation surrounding you and helping you, then we can act creative. Whether it is just funding it and saying, hey, we're going to foot the bill and get this child daycare set up until the state gets everything in place and can set it up that way. Or maybe they're, members of the congregation who have that time and ability to step in and help out at least temporarily. But it's those little things that for another foster family would be a deal breaker and they're just going to displace this child. If we can serve together as a community, maybe we can help save that placement and provide that support that the foster family needs and get them through those hard points.
What do you think the difference is, or the impact is, especially on the child or children, when a congregation not just, funds or throws money at them or at this family, but actually participates? What kind of difference does that make for the child when you have so many hands on deck, a whole church family that loves you and is caring for you? What do you think the long-lasting impact could be?
Numerous studies have shown that the impact upon a child as far as the quality of care that they get in foster care, and the number one way that it was described in most of the studies was how much the child felt accepted and part of the family. To that degree, that has a significant impact on how they're going to do for the rest of their lives. And even the ones who, let's say their outcome is not the best, it's not what we would hope for them. Even in those scenarios, in speaking in these studies, even those future adults, those former foster children, they've acknowledged that they still remember those times and it still has some impact on them. So even in those scenarios where, because not every placement's going to work out. I mean, I realize that, you're talking about a child that's damaged, literally. Their brain, and I've seen the scans on these children, their brains do not develop as a typical child's brain would develop. They literally lose the ability to make sound, logical, executive decisions because they're so overstimulated in the fight or flight response that they become highly emotional and they lose that capability of making cogent decisions. And so you'll look at a child and you'll say, why in the world did you do that? Like, you're going to get in trouble for that. And for us, we look at that, we're like, we just can't understand it. But when you understand how their brains have literally not developed correctly, you understand that it's not their fault. And I think that's another big thing about foster care. It's not just that children need a home, they need a good home. And I think that is part of the issue too, is that when you go into foster care training, there's such an urgency because there's such a shortfall of foster parents in the nation that they just need to get you out there and they need to get a kid in your home. And they don't properly prepare a lot of foster parents, I feel, for the things that they're going to deal with. Because it's not going to be a Hallmark movie. It's not. You're not going to get a child who runs into your arms, hugs you, and then everything is fine and dandy, and you adopt that child and you ride off into the sunset. The reality is these children have experienced unthinkable, unspeakable acts. I mean, I've seen a lot of things in my time, and it is horrifying to understand some of the experiences that these children have gone through. And for us to think that they're just going to understand what love is immediately is a mistake, because they don't understand it because they've never experienced it. And so we as foster parents and we as the supports in the congregation need to be able to understand that so that we can help this child and not judge them on their behaviors. Because frankly, a lot of them, they do. They have very difficult behaviors. You know, and again, I acknowledge that not every placement is going to work. Sometimes the situation is not, you know, you just can't keep it together. But at the same time, we need to make sure that we're not displacing children based on somebody throwing a fit or somebody refusing to eat their peas at dinner. Like, we have to understand that there's going to be a process to work through to help these children heal and learn how to trust.
How did you then, you know, with the help of the rest of your congregation, how were you able to kind of pitch this idea to your church? And how were you able to kind of convince or come alongside these two families at Hope to, you know, recognize that they, you know, are in a great position to bring, you know, children into their home? Not everybody has a Dr. Engel in their church, you know? So how do other churches do that?
So first of all, I am more than happy to make myself available to anybody who would like to reach out and get some guidance or at least have an understanding. I've also submitted some paperwork to the LCMS that, you know, I hope they disseminate for me as far as just some terminology that's associated with child dependency, some explanations as to the time frames and some of the technicalities of how that process works. You know, there are, complicated terms like ICPC and, you know, ICMA and things like that that people aren't going to understand. And I'm more than happy to go ahead and respond to anybody who wants to reach out if they have concerns or they would like some advice as to, you know, what to expect. But really, that's the other thing I think that we as Lutherans in particular can provide that perhaps other foster parents cannot, is that, you know, that we comprehend that our entire religion is based on sacrifice, right? The ultimate sacrifice of our Lord. And this is not that. This is not dying on the cross, but it is a sacrifice. And I think that when we look at it in those terms, that being a foster parent, it's not about us. It's not about me stepping up so that I can get acknowledgement or praise or feel good about what I did. It's about putting myself out there, sacrificing time, like maybe I'm not going to be able to go and see the movie that I wanted to because I've got a kid who's flipping their lid today. And I got to take that time and work with that child and calm them down and get them back to the place where they need to be. And I think when you look at it in that perspective, and you realize that it truly is God's work that we're doing as foster parents and as supports of those foster parents, it's not just something we're doing because it's quote unquote the right thing to do. We're doing it because we should be doing it, because that's what our religion says that we should be doing.
So then how would it transform the entire state of our U.S. dependency system if every Lutheran congregation was able to identify one or two families who could foster children? What would that do?
Significantly. And so right now, there are probably a few hundred minimum, a few hundred children across this country right now that are sitting in an office, and that's where they're going to sleep tonight. There are a few hundred others who are going to go to a one-night policing. They're going to pack up all their belongings in a garbage bag, because that's what we do, because they don't have suitcases or nice travel gear. So we grab a garbage bag, we put their belongings in it, and we ship them over to this foster house that will take them for the evening. But they're not a long-term placement, so we pick them up in the morning. We might take them to a rec center, if you will, for the day. If they're lucky, they get to go to school. But a lot of these kids won't go to school because you need a permanent address in order to qualify to go to school. So, you know, these are the unknown secrets of child dependency, unfortunately. So you got a child that's not going to school, and then that evening, we don't know where they're going to go. It might take us until 10 o'clock at night before we find another place that will take them for the evening. So you have these children that are literally just going to these night-to-night placements for a week, 2 weeks, a month. If there are 6,000 congregations in the LCMS across the country, if half of those stood up and took one foster child per congregation, we would eliminate that, basically. We would eliminate that overnight travesty that is occurring. And so, again, that was the focus of my studies, is that, you know, you talk about, and neglect is actually, they've actually found that neglect is more traumatizing than actual physical abuse. Neglecting a child is going to have a greater impact, and it's going to be harder to change the effects of than physical abuse. And so you have a child now who has been seriously traumatized. The state walks in and they remove that child from that trauma, and we all clap because they've done a great job. That's the problem. That's not the end of the story. Like, we need to find a good home for that child, and it has to be stable. We can't just keep displacing it. Every time we displace a child, you create more trauma. When you put a child in these night-to-night situations like I just described, or sleeping in an office, you're traumatizing that child again. Because it becomes crystal clear to that child that there is no one on this earth that cares enough about them. Like, they get that. They get that sleeping on a cot in an office is for a reason. It's because no one wants them. And no child should ever have to come to that conclusion. But that's what's happened.
So in conclusion, Dr. Engel, is, you know, you have an opportunity to send out a nationwide plea for folks to be involved. What would you have to say to our listeners, or how would you ask them to consider helping in such a way?
I would ask anyone to prayerfully consider your scenario, your situation right now, and really ask yourself whether you're capable of being a foster parent or not. Because I do. I respect the fact that not everyone has that ability. They either don't have, you know, the means or the time because of the type of job they have. I get that. But if you are, if that's a possibility, truly ask yourself why you're not doing it then. Like, what is the reasoning that you're coming up with to say no to that? And ask yourself, is that really legitimate? Because the question I like to ask is, if a child knocked on your front door right now and told you that they had no place to stay and there was no one on earth willing to care for them, would you close your door? Would you just shut the door on them and say, I'm sorry, I'm not capable? Because that child is knocking right now. Like, literally, these children are there. The need is there. And so I think that's the big difference between this ministry versus other foster parents. We're not just doing it because it's something to do. We're doing it because this is the very teachings of Jesus. He makes it very clear, and it should be crystal clear to us that we should be doing what we can. And if you're not capable of being a foster parent, then you should be thinking about how you can support a foster parent. And it really should be somebody within the congregation, because there are a lot of confidentiality issues, and trying to find somebody, you know, outside of the congregation, it would be very sticky. So it's better to try and do this as a congregation. It simplifies a lot of issues. And I think it also shows the unity of our Christian community. I mean, what better way to show people what a Christian and what a Lutheran truly is than by us stepping up as congregations and making this our mission, our ministry. There are other ways to help out. One, if I may quickly, is the Guardian Ad Litem, or CASA, which stands for Court-Appointed Special Advocate. These are volunteer positions that you can advocate for a child in the courtroom. You don't need to be a lawyer. You don't need legal experience. You'll get some training on that. They'll work with you on that. The good programs will help you out with that. But another thing that people don't realize is that when these children go into court, there is literally not one single person who is dedicated to the best interest of that child. The judge is making decisions based on the law. The state attorney is representing state statutes and making sure that state issues are being addressed and that there are, you know, certain check boxes are being checked off. Case manager literally has an obligation to both parents and children. So it's kind of mixed there. So if mom wants to be reunified and the child is not doing well, who does the case manager side with? And it really creates conflicting issues. Both parents have attorneys. That child literally has no one in that courtroom that is standing only for them. And as a guardian ad litem or a court-appointed special advocate, you literally can be that person who will stand in that courtroom and tell the judge your recommendations without any obligation to anybody else. You literally stand there and say, "Your Honor, I disagree. I think this placement is in the best interest of this child." And you talk about the investigation that you've done and the people you've talked to, and you make that recommendation. I've done it myself. And it is empowering because you are literally putting the child first because no one else in that courtroom is doing that. They all have other obligations, other people that they have to satisfy. So that is also an impactful way that Lutherans could help out and try and do the best for these children as possible.
And just if I can sum it up, that Christians, the church, Lutherans specifically, we don't have an option to not show mercy. It's the command of our Lord. And so there's no lack of need for mercy when we look about, and especially with these children. And again, it's our responsibility as adults to care for children, not the other way around. And so we really should always be looking, whether it's our own biological children or children of others, how can we care for them? How can we protect them? That's one of our jobs as adults. So thank you so much, Dr. Engel, for coming on, for sharing with us so that we could, you know, have this picture painted of really what kind of is going on. A lot of times we have issues that are unseen, so they kind of stay out of mind. And it's important for us to put this in front of people, including myself, so that we realize this work is needed and it's very impactful. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you so much for our listeners for tuning in. If you liked what you heard, please leave us a review and don't forget to click the follow or subscribe button so you don't miss out on upcoming episodes. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram at LCMS Life. And finally, listeners, we want to hear from you. Do you have an idea about a guest you'd like to hear from or a topic you want talked about? Email us at friendsforlife@lcms.org. We want to hear from you about what you want to hear about when it comes to issues of life.
Thanks for joining us. Friends for Life is a podcast that discusses the life God has given and the people He has called you to serve, right where you are, in God's mission.